We return this evening to The Life Divine, Chapter 23, Man and the Evolution. Sri Aurobindo, in our last paragraph, was describing how if Satchitananda, existence, consciousness, force, and bliss are embedded, immanent in the universe, it is not irrational to perceive that the manifestation of this consciousness force through the process of time, through the coils of evolution, could have a purpose in it, could have teleology behind it. Telos, Greek, purpose. That the universe is not a freakish accident, but is a willed evolution. Evolution, let us remind ourselves, is a word in English that comes from the Latin, e volvere, which means to roll out. It was first used in English, as best I can find out, in the year 1647 by H. Moore, who used it in a sense that suggested that evolution was one movement of progress. Now, Darwin, of course, made the term famous, but he only used it once. He didn't like the term evolution because he did not want to identify the movement of speciation with progress. He did not want to equate the two, so he didn't use it except for the last word in his volume, The Origin of Species. After that, he never used the term again. For us, Sri Aurobindo is describing how evolution is a progressive manifestation of all the terms of being which are present at the very core and the basis of the universe, and they appear one after the other. And he's going to go through a very straightforward exposition of that in the next few pages. So here we are. He begins, a theory of spiritual evolution is not identical with the scientific theory of form evolution and physical life evolution. It must stand on its own inherent justification. It may accept the scientific account of physical evolution as a support or an element, but the support is not indispensable. The scientific theory is concerned only with the outward and visible machinery and process, with the detail of nature's execution, with the physical development of things in matter, and the law of development of life and mind in matter. Its account of the process may have to be considerably changed or maybe dropped altogether in the light of new discovery, but that will not affect the self-evident fact of a spiritual evolution, an evolution of consciousness, a progression of the soul's manifestation in material existence. So there, that last phrase sums it all up. The spiritual evolution can use physicality as a mode of its development, but is not dependent upon it. Is not limited to it. He continues, in its outward aspects, this is what the theory of evolution comes to. There is, in the scale of terrestrial existence, a development of forms, of bodies, a progressively complex and competent organization of matter, of life in matter, of consciousness in living matter. In this scale, the better organized the form, the more it is capable of housing a better organized, a more complex and capable, a more developed or evolved life and consciousness. Let's pause for a second and recall that the term evolution may be new in English, but the idea of developing life forms is not new. In fact, Sri Aurobindo will shortly refer to that. But this idea right here that he's just expressed, a scale of terrestrial development with forms mounting into superior ranks, is familiar to anybody who's read Anaximander, one of the pre-Socratic Greek philosophers. He continues, once the evolutionary hypothesis is put forward and the facts supporting it are marshaled, this aspect of the terrestrial existence becomes so striking as to appear indisputable. Matter, life, mind. The precise machinery by which this is done, or the exact genealogy or chronological succession of types of being, is a secondary, though in itself an interesting and important question. The development of one form of life out of a precedent less evolved form, natural selection, the struggle for life, the survival of acquired characteristics, may or may not be accepted, but the fact of a successive creation with a developing plan in it is the one conclusion which is of primary consequence. This is pivotal to Sri Aurobindo. We see in the development of life out of matter, of mind out of living matter, a purpose in the evolution, in the development of the cosmos. And why would that be accidental? He finds that it is a purposive development of the embedded spirit at the base of things. Another self-evident conclusion is that there is a graduated necessary succession in the evolution. First, the evolution of matter. Next, the evolution of life in matter. Then, the evolution of mind in living matter. And in this last stage, an animal evolution followed by a human evolution. The first three terms of the succession are too evident to be disputable. It may be debated whether there was a succession of man to animal or a simultaneous initial development, man outstripping the animal in mind evolution. A theory has even been put forward that man was not the last, but the first and eldest of the animal species. This priority of man is an ancient conception, but it was not universal. It is born of the sense of the clear supremacy of man among earthly creatures, the dignity of this supremacy seeming to demand a priority in birth. But in evolutionary fact, the superior is not prior, but posterior in appearance. The less developed precedes the more developed and prepares it. In fact, the idea of the priority of the lower forms of life is not altogether absent in ancient thinking. Apart from mythical accounts of creation, we find already in ancient and medieval thought in India utterances that favor the priority of the animal over man in the time succession, in a sense that agrees with the modern evolutionary conception. An Upanishad declares that the self or spirit, after deciding on life creation, first formed animal kinds like the cow and horse. But the gods, who are, in the thought of the Upanishads, powers of consciousness and powers of nature, found them to be insufficient vehicles. And the spirit finally created the form of man, which the gods saw to be excellently made and sufficient, and they entered into it for their cosmic functions. This is interesting. The gods take birth in the human to achieve cosmic intents. They have an aim which they unfold in the process of time. And the human is the chosen element among all the creatures to express these godlike powers. This, by the way, Sri Aurobindo doesn't note it here, but this is from the Aitareya Upanishad, the first chapter, the second section. He continues, "This is a clear parable of the creation of more and more developed forms till one was found that was capable of housing a developed consciousness. So, over a period of time, evolution upon Earth develops, prepares a vehicle in which the mind can sit and the gods can play in that mind and affect their cosmic aims. In the Puranas, it is stated that the tamasic animal creation was the first in time. Tamas is the Indian word for the principle of inertia of consciousness and force, a consciousness dull and sluggish and incompetent in its play, is said to be tamasic. A force, a life energy that is indolent and limited in its capacity, bound to a narrow range of instinctive impulses, not developing, not seeking farther, not urged to a greater kinetic action or a more luminously conscious action, would be assigned to the same category. The animal, in whom there is this less developed force of consciousness, is prior in creation. The more developed human consciousness, in which there is a greater force of kinetic mind energy and light of perception, is a later creation." So this is strewn throughout the devotional treatises that we call the Puranas, centered on the personal manifestations of the Godhead. The Tantra speaks of a soul fallen from its status, passing through many lakhs of births in plant and animal forms before it can reach the human level and be ready for salvation. May as well say it here. This is, of course, the Vishvasara Tantra early on, and it describes, in fact, that there are 84 lakhs, and a lakh is 100,000. So 84 times 100,000 births you go through before you can reach the human level and prepare for liberation, for perfection of consciousness. So the human birth in the Tantra is a precious attainment and cannot be looked at lightly, cannot be casually tossed aside, but we must fix our resolution and do our very best because we have worked very hard to attain this birth. Here again, he says, there is implied the conception of vegetable and animal life forms as the lower steps of a ladder, humanity as the last or culminating development of the conscious being, the form which the soul has to inhabit in order to be capable of the spiritual motive and a spiritual issue out of mentality, life, and physicality. This is indeed the normal conception, and it recommends itself so strongly both to reason and intuition that it hardly needs debate. The conclusion is almost unescapable. That, in other words, the forms which can house a greater consciousness are prepared over time, and the greater forms are nearer to us in time. So evolution is climbing or spiraling upwards, creating, manifesting, shaping the forms that are necessary for it. It is against this background of a developing evolutionary process that we have to look at man is origin and first appearance, his status in the manifestation. So we have to see where man comes from and where we rank in the order of evolution. There are here two possibilities. Either there was the sudden appearance of a human body and consciousness in the earth nature, an abrupt creation or independent automatic manifestation of reasoning mentality in the material world intervening upon a previous similar manifestation of subconscious life forms and of living conscious bodies and matter. Or else, there was an evolution of humanity out of animal being, slow perhaps in its preparation and in its stages of development, but with strong leaps of change at the decisive points of the transition. The sudden leaps would be exampled in modern thinking by Smuts in his philosophy, coming out of South Africa, wasn't it? Yeah. The latter theory offers no difficulty, for it is certain that changes of characteristics in the type, though not of the fundamental type itself, can be brought about in species or genus. Indeed, this has already been done by man himself, and its possibilities are being strikingly worked out on a small scale by experimental science. And it may fairly be assumed that the secretly conscious energy in nature could affect large-scale operations of the kind and bring about considerable and decisive developments by means of its own creative conventions. Well, embedded in this language is one of the early ideas of Aristotle. Isn't it interesting that all these Greek thinkers begin to appear in Sri Aurobindo, who was, of course, a master of Greek? Aristotle, who had the idea of the fixity of the forms of life, and there's no variance in it, but also assigned a kind of potentiality to nature, which did lead to the possibility of other forms emergent. So we see here a kind of emergentism that things suddenly appear and abruptly break off from things gifted to us from the past, and the idea of a gradual evolution through forms prepared slowly over a long period of time. So is it the sudden transition, or is it the long, slow preparation that results in the evolution that we arrive at a human? The necessary condition, he says, for the change from the normal animal to the human character of existence would be a development of the physical organization which would capacitate a rapid progression, a reversal or turnover of the consciousness, a reaching to a new height, and a looking down from it at the lower stages, a heightening and widening of capacity, which would enable the being to take up the old animal faculties with a larger and more plastic, a human intelligence, and at the same time, or later, to develop greater and subtler powers proper to the new type of being, powers of reason, reflection, complex observation, organized invention, thought, and discovery. If there is an emergent consciousness force, there would be no difficulty in the transition, the instrument being provided, except the difficulty of the obstruction and resistance of the material inconscience. That he would use the term emergent is telling. At the time when Sri Aurobindo was first formulating his ideas of conscious evolution, 1914 to 1920, let's say, Samuel Alexander had not yet published. Neither had, what was his name? I think C. Lloyd Morgan, who originated emergent evolutionism. But this idea that there could be abrupt moments of transition with a correlation between the physical and the psychological or psychic, so that the one betokened the other, and that the divine God directs the course of evolution in the universe through these kinds of events in time, was articulated shortly after Sri Aurobindo had published his ideas. And we don't know if the English versions of the Arya reached these readers in the West, or if the French versions reached readers in the West, and certainly Teilhard de Chardin in France, but that there should suddenly be a great deal written about subjects which were native to Sri Aurobindo's pen is very interesting and suggestive. Intellectual history would be appropriate in this score. An emergent consciousness force. So let's remember, consciousness force, chit shakti, is the extension of real being, sat, sat, chit, shakti. What is missing here except the purpose for the manifestation of sat through chit shakti, conscious power, consciousness force? Its aim is ananda through the evolution of time. So sat chit ananda is seeking itself for its own purposes through the evolution of time. The animal, he says, has already some of the corresponding qualities on a limited scale for action only in a rudimentary organization, crude and simple, with a very inferior scope and plasticity, a narrower and more casual command of the faculty. But especially, the working of these faculties is more mechanical, less deliberate, marked with the character of an automatism of nature energy, driving an operation of primitive consciousness, and not, as in man, of a conscious energy, observing and to a great extent directing and governing and deliberately changing or modifying its own operations. So he's not saying that consciousness, perhaps even mentality, is not available to animal creation, but where it is present there, it is driven by an automatism of nature. In the animal, will works automatically. In the human, will works consciously. So in the human, we begin to see the possibility of a free-ranging consciousness and a true free will. It at least is in bud in the human. Other animal habits of consciousness are not fundamentally different from man's. All he had to do was to develop and enlarge them on a higher mental level and, wherever possible, to mentalize, refine, subtleize, in brief, to bring to them the enlightenment of his new understanding and intellectual capacity and a power of reasoned control denied to the animal. And you will remember earlier passages where Sri Aurobindo has accorded to the animal kingdom much greater powers of reason and mentality than the human, with his sense of superiority, is willing to condone or recognize. And yet, they are not used to their fullest. In the human, they get used more completely. When he uses the term enlightenment here, let's make sure we understand. He's not talking about the Buddha's enlightenment. He's talking here about the Age of Enlightenment, about things brought to their apex of reason, mentality, made full. This change or reversal once effected, the power of the human mind to work upon itself and things, create, know, speculate, would develop in the course of his evolution, even if, as is conceivable, they were at the beginning small in scope, nearer to the animal, still comparatively simple and crude in their action. Such a reversal has been made in each radical transition of nature. Life force, emerging, turns upon matter, imposes a vital content on the operations of material energy, while it develops also its own new movements and operations. Life mind emerges in life force and matter, and imposes its content of consciousness on their operations, while it develops also its own action and faculties. A new, greater emergence and reversal, the emergence of humanity, is in line with nature's precedents. It would be a new application of the general principle. This theory is therefore easy to accept. Its working is intelligible. But the other hypothesis presents considerable difficulties. In other words, the abrupt appearance is difficult to explain. The gradual appearance we can understand. Let's read it again. This theory is therefore easy to accept. Its working is intelligible. But the other hypothesis presents considerable difficulties. On the side of consciousness, the new manifestation, the human, could be accounted for by an upsurge of concealed consciousness from the involution in universal nature. But in that case, it must have had some material form already existent for its vehicle of emergence, the vehicle being adapted by the force of the emergence itself to the needs of a new inner creation. Or else, a rapid divergence from previous physical types or patterns may have brought a new being into existence. But whichever the hypothesis accepted, this means an evolutionary process. There is only a difference in the method and machinery of the divergence or transition. Or there may have been, on the contrary, not an upsurgence, but a descent of mentality from a mind plane above us, perhaps the descent of a soul or mental being into terrestrial nature. The difficulty would then be the appearance of the human body. Too complex and difficult an organ to have been suddenly created or manifested. For such a miraculous speed of process, though quite possible on a superphysical plane of being, does not seem to figure among the normal possibles or potentials of material energy. It could only happen there by an intervention of a superphysical force or law of nature, or by a creator mind, acting with full power and directly on matter. An action of a superphysical force and a creator may be conceded in every new appearance in matter. Each such appearance is at bottom a miracle operated by a secret consciousness supported by a veiled mind energy or life energy. But the action is nowhere seen to be direct, overt, self-sufficient. It is always superimposed on an already realized physical basis and acts by an extension of some established process of nature. It is more conceivable that there was an opening of some existing body to a supraphysical influx so that it was transformed into a new body. But no such event can likely be assumed to have taken place in the past history of material nature. In order to happen, it would seem to need either the conscious intervention of an invisible mental being to form the body he intended to inhabit, or else a previous development of a mental being in matter itself, who would be already able to receive a superphysical power and impose it on the rigid and narrow formulas of his physical existence. So this is the problem for Sri Aurobindo. How is it that the human physical vehicle appears ready and capable of holding this new consciousness, capable of taking a gallon of consciousness into a quart container, if we relied on the slowness of the typical animal evolution? Or how do you account for the sudden precipitation of a being ready-made, fully thunderously ready, that can take a gallon instead of a quart? Where does that vehicle come from? So, is there an occult pressure to create it? Is there a preparation from below to be ready for the installation of this new consciousness? He continues, otherwise, we must suppose that there was a pre-existent body already so much evolved as to be fitted for the reception of a vast mental influx, or capable of a pliable response to the descent into it of a mental being. So we're back to the metaphor that the Upanishad offered. In the Aitareya, it describes how this succession of beings, the cow, the horse, etc., each is offered to the gods, and the gods say, it is not sufficient, it is not sufficient. And only when the human form is presented do they say, this is well, this is truly formed, this is beautiful, it is sufficient, we shall descend. It is quite conceivable that such an evolution from below and such a descent from above cooperated in the appearance of humanity in Earth nature, that there is a call and response. There is a preparation, a stretching out, a seeking for a greater consciousness, and a response from above that in their co-agency creates a form appropriate to hold mind. The secret psychical entity already there in the animal might have itself called down the mental being, the mind purusha, manomaya purusha, into the realm of living matter in order to take up the vital mental energy already at work and lift it into a higher mentality. But this would still be a process of evolution, the higher plane only intervening to assist the appearance and enlargement of its own principle and terrestrial nature. This is a concept that is dear to Sri Aurobindo. No sudden miraculous intervention that takes us from one saltus to another, from one plane to another, but a purposive evolution from below upwards, yes, accepting as co-agents the higher forces, the superphysical forces, when they want to blend and descend their energies into the material form, so that there is interaction. We prove, therefore, that there is one cosmos, and however many planes there may be, they are interconnected. even here in the physical, even as we rise out of involved consciousness through the process of evolution, through all the various types, stretching into mentality, and now perhaps beyond mentality. So I think we'll put a bookmark there, and we'll finish the chapter next week, Man and the Evolution. We have tonight a section from Sri Aurobindo's epic poem, Savitri, Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Little Life. A difficult evolution from below, called a masked intervention from above. Else this great, blind, inconscient universe could never have disclosed its hidden mind, or even in blinkers worked in beast and man the intelligence that devised the cosmic scheme. At first, he saw a dim, obscure mind power, moving, concealed by matter and dumb life. A current thin, it streamed in life's vast flow, tossing and drifting under a drifting sky, amid the surge and glimmering tremulous wash, released in splash of sense and feelings waves. In the deep mist of an insentient world, its huddled waves and foam of consciousness ran, pressing and eddying through a narrow strait, carrying experience in its crowded pace. It flowed, emerging into upper light, from the deep pool of its subliminal birth, to reach some high existence still unknown. There was no thinking self. Aim, there was none. All was unorganized stress and seekings vague. Only to the unstable surface rose sensations, stabs and edges of desire, and passion's leaps and brief emotion's cries, a casual colloquy of flesh with flesh, a murmur of heart to longing, wordless heart, glimmerings of knowledge with no shape of thought, and jets of subconscious will or hunger's pulls. All was dim sparkle on a foaming top. It whirled around a drifting shadow self, on an inconscient flood of force in time. Then came the pressure of a seeing power that drew all into a dancing, turbid mass, circling around a single luminous point, center of reference in a conscious field, figure of a unitary light within. It lit the impulse of the half-sentient flood, even an illusion gave of fixity, as if a sea could serve as a firm soil. That strange observing power imposed its sight. It forced on flux a limit and a shape. It gave its stream a lower narrow bank, drew lines to snare the spirit's formlessness. It fashioned the life-mind of bird and beast, the answer of the reptile and the fish, the primitive pattern of the thoughts of man. A finite movement of the infinite came winging its way through a wide air of time, a march of knowledge moved in nescience and guarded in the form a separate soul. Its right to be immortal it reserved, but built a wall against the siege of death, and threw a hook to clutch eternity. A thinking entity appeared in space. That's us. Can we do better? So, namaste. Jai Ma.